When I was in college, if one of the guys in our dorm had been rejected in his request for a date or had not been on a date for a very long time, we would occasionally call him into one of our rooms and we would gather around him. We'd sit him down to have a little intervention. And we would say to him, "We think you might have the gift." Now, I was at a Baptist college, and we Baptists knew our Bibles, and we knew that in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul referred to the gift of celibacy as the gift. But just in case it wasn't completely clear to our brother, we would sing to the tune of the 80s song from Roxette, "She's Got the Look, He's Got the Gift." Na 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 na, he's got the gift. And we would laugh because this is Baptist adolescent at the highest form of irony. Because who wants this gift? This is the gift that nobody wants. I was the beginning generation who was going to Josh McDowell conferences with big banners across the stage that said, "True love waits." Waits for what? The gift of celibacy? I don't think so. Now, what I want us to consider tonight, having somehow drawn the short straw and being given the topic of celibacy in our series on Summer of Love, I want us to consider tonight, did Paul's listeners laugh to themselves when Paul referred to the gift of celibacy? Or did they nudge each other and say, "Here's Paul being ironic again"? Or would they have taken his affirmations of celibacy to be unmarried and sexually chaste with absolute seriousness? And if so, what should that mean for us today? So, looking at our New Testament passage from tonight, if you've got your Bibles, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, this is the text in which celibacy is referred to as a gift. And so we're going to look at that in particular. Now, let's remember, Paul is talking about marriage and celibacy to a group of Christians who, for the most part, have a different set of cultural assumptions than we do. For one thing that we need to keep in mind, the infant mortality rate in the Roman Empire during the first century was extremely high. And so for the population of a city like Corinth, to whom Paul is writing, each of the women in a city like that would need to produce, on average, about 5 children in her lifetime. And so this meant that it was expected that she would get started early, and women would get married at the age of 14 or 15, sometime in their teenage years, to get started to having children. And this meant that marriage was, for the most part, an intensely practical calculation. And of course, this is true and has been true for the entire world, really, until recently. It was not about individual fulfillment or happiness. You got married in order to create legitimate heirs, to ensure the perpetuation of your society, your family's name, and your family's property. Marriage, the primary purpose of marriage, was to keep the world going as we know it. Then Christianity comes along and it presents this idea of a new world breaking into this one. The resurrection of Christ from the grave was this great disruption, and early Christians began to think, what does this mean for the current social order? Many assumed that the full consummation of God's kingdom was potentially coming anytime, and therefore some early Christian groups sought to hasten this process of social transformation by renouncing all sexual activity in order to bring marriage and childbirth to an end, because if marriage and childbirth come to an end, the fabric of organized society begins to crumble. So there was this kind of apocalyptic thinking in the air in certain quarters of the first century church. There were other groups of Christians, and they were suspicious of marriage for a different set of reasons. Some Christian converts who had studied with groups like the Stoics or the Cynics or other traditions of Greek philosophy were often deeply suspicious of the body, and they believed that anything that had to do with the body distracted from the person's soul, from their soul pursuing more lofty pursuits. And therefore, if a person wanted to be truly spiritual, then even marital intimacy would be renounced. So these ways of thinking were almost certainly influential in some way or another in the background to the group of Christians that Paul is writing to here in this chapter. And we're sort of listening to one side of the argument here with Paul, but piecing things together from what he's saying here in chapter 7, it sounds like influential voices were telling folks in the congregation, number one, don't get married. Number two, if you are married, don't have marital relations with each other. And number three, if you think that you are not going to be able to practice abstinence while being married, then get divorced. And so one of Paul's main agendas in this chapter is to say, no, no, no. If you're married, stay married. And moreover, he says, do not deprive each other of marital intimacy except maybe occasionally and briefly for periods of prayer. Now, I briefly considered just ending the sermon there and saying, you that are married, let's just go out and really live this passage this week. But that would be to ignore something else in this passage. Paul is making the primary argument about the validity of marriage, but along the way, he very clearly also affirms the call to celibacy for some Christians. What's interesting is he's very careful in his wording here, because while he wants to affirm celibacy, he does not want to affirm it for the same reasons that the Corinthians do. So while the Corinthians affirm celibacy, perhaps as a way to hasten the demise of the old social order, or perhaps as a way to elevate the soul over the body, Paul wants no part of celibacy for those reasons. But he also wants to allow that there is much good that can come from being celibate. So look at verses 6 and 7. He says, now, as a concession, not as a command, I say this, I wish that all were as I myself am, Paul being celibate. But each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. And so Paul says clearly that celibacy is to be affirmed. I wish that all, he says, and by all he means rhetorically, not literally, I wish that all were like me, but it is for those for whom it is a gift from God. Now, Paul does not go to any great lengths in this passage to develop this idea of celibacy being a gift, but I want us to simply pause for just a moment on that concept and think briefly about the ways in which celibacy might be a gift. And too often, I think, when we're thinking about this, we're perhaps too simplistic and think about celibacy as a gift of subtraction and not addition. And by subtraction, I mean that we assume that the gift of celibacy is simply for those who somehow have less sexual desire than others. And while this might be true in some cases, books that perhaps some of you have read, such as The Cloister Walk by Kathleen Norris, or The Hidden Life of Nuns by Cheryl Reed, which explore the life of celibate men and women in contemporary religious orders, show that in general this is not the case. Most of those who are celibate are not so because of a lack of sexual desire, but because they have been given the gift of an expanded vision of what they can do and the breadth of impact they can have by being freed from the more narrow commitments of marriage and family. And rather than repressing or ignoring Their desires most speak of using spiritual disciplines to redirect and channel those desires into love and service of others. In Cheryl Reed's book in particular, she interviews activist sisters who teach in universities or who work as prison chaplains or who minister to drug addicts in urban safe houses. And for them, the gift of celibacy has added to their world. It has expanded their impact, and it has increased their community. So the gift of celibacy is, in other words, a gift of freedom. Paul writes in verse 28, if you marry, you've not sinned, yet I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried person is anxious only about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. And so in Paul's case, it meant that he did not have to take into account a wife or children if he's being led by the Spirit to preach in dangerous areas of the Roman Empire. It means that he doesn't have to worry about piano lessons or college funds for little Paul Jr. down the road. The time that he might have spent nurturing his relationship with his wife, he can spend developing friendships and mentoring others. Paul, in other words, affirms celibacy so that it can free one to serve Christ and the world more expansively. I once read an interview with John Stott, the Christian statesman who died in 2011, in which he talks about his own call to celibacy. And he said, quote, in spite of rumors to the contrary, I have never taken a solemn vow or heroic decision to remain single. On the contrary, during my 20s and 30s, like most people, I was expecting to marry one day. In fact, during this period, I twice began to develop a relationship with a lady who I thought might be God's choice of life partner for me. But when the time came to make a decision, I can best explain it by saying that I lacked an assurance from God that he meant me to go forward. So I drew back. And when that happened twice, I began to believe that God meant me to remain single. Looking back with the benefit of hindsight, I think I know why. I could never have traveled or written as extensively as I have done if I had the responsibilities of wife and family. I once read a letter from Billy Graham to John Stott in which this freedom from ministry was acknowledged. Graham wrote to Stott, quote, thank you for your November letter. Just reading it made me a bit exhausted. How do you do it, my friend? If you had a wife, five children, five in-laws, and 15 grandchildren, it would be rather difficult. Please forgive me if I'm not able to keep up with you. Here's the question, though. If we can recognize celibacy as a gift, not for all but for some, why does it not occupy greater prominence or is not afforded greater respect in Christian circles today, at least those circles outside of the Roman Catholic Church? I think there are many things we could point out. Some might point out the way in which the church has been deeply shaped by a surrounding culture that views sexual expression as a necessity, as essential to human happiness. And so even the very idea of saying no to that desire as a means towards a life of greater love and greater impact has become increasingly implausible in today's world. But I think another hurdle to viewing celibacy as a gift is the way in which relatively recent historical factors have elevated the intimacy of marriage over other forms of intimacy and community that used to be available but today are in shorter supply. Therefore, a life of celibacy today is potentially without the kinds of support that once made it more possible. And it can therefore feel to many that marriage is the only option for experiencing lifelong community, intimacy, and bonds of affection. It was not always this way. So as Stephanie Kuntz, the historian, points out in her book, A History of Marriage, through most of history, quote, it was considered dangerously antisocial to be too emotionally attached to one spouse because that diluted loyalties to family, neighbors, and societies at large. She goes on to say, until the mid-19th century, the word love was used more frequently to describe feelings for neighbors, relatives, and fellow church members than spouses. The emotional lives of Victorian middle-class women revolved around deeply felt female bonds that overshadowed the respectful affection they felt for their husbands. Men, too, sought intimacy, she says, outside the family circle. A man could write a letter to his fiancée recounting his pleasure at falling asleep on the bosom of his best friend without fearing that she might think him gay. When couples first began to go on honeymoons in the 19th century, they often took friends and families along for company. Now, there's historical reasons for this. Until around 1850 in the U.S., the main requirement that most Americans had for their marriage revolved around food protection and shelter. If you had an emotional connection with your spouse, that was a bonus for your marriage, but it was not central to its purpose. From around 1850 or so onwards, however, Americans shifted from largely rural to urban lives, and as people grew wealthier and more mobile, and as other social institutions became stronger, people began looking to marriage primarily for love and companionship, even as other forms of community became less central. Furthermore, I should just say, as a parenthetical side point, I think that we've all been impacted by Freud more than we think we have. Freud saw sexual desire as the key behind any and all relationships, and that fear and suspicion that Freud introduced still haunts friendships and other platonic relationships even today. All of this means that the breadth of intimacy and community that everyone needs, whether they are married or single, is especially difficult today. And incidentally, it puts an incredible weight on marriage to deliver a comprehensive range of goods in that one relationship, and it makes any consideration of celibacy as a gift that much more implausible. So, what might we do to address these hurdles? I don't think there are any easy answers or quick fixes. But if we are to take Scripture seriously and accept that celibacy truly is a gift, how might we enable it to flourish in the church today? And I want to suggest two things. First, we must continue to emphasize the biblical and theological truth of the church as first family. At our most recent parish retreat, we talked about the unofficial motto of Res being, he sets the lonely in families. And I think that's exactly right. An emphasis on the church as first family does not mean that the biological family is not important or that we should not nurture and protect marriage and family, especially as it's under assault in today's culture. Paul makes clear in our passage tonight the ongoing validity and importance of marriage. But Paul's affirmation of celibacy also makes clear that getting married and having a biological family is not the be-all, end-all. And in this, Paul was in direct continuity with Jesus. As we heard in our gospel reading tonight from Luke 20, Jesus said, in this age, people marry and are given in marriage, but those in the age to come will neither marry nor be given in marriage. Why is the future not marriage? Because complete union with God, of which marriage is a sacramental but incomplete sign, will be fully realized. We will not take the Eucharist in the age to come. Why? Because we will be feasting with Christ. We will not be married in the age to come. Why? Because we will be unified with the person that we desire the most. In this respect, therefore, celibate disciples of Christ in this age stand as prophetic witnesses and reminders of humanity's future with God. Of course, Jesus challenges the ultimacy of the biological family elsewhere too. He says in Matthew 10 that he came to bring a sword that would separate parent from child, brother from brother. He says in Matthew 8 that a young man who has just lost his father should skip the funeral and come and follow him. In Mark 3, Jesus' family appears at the scene of his busy ministry and calls for him, and Jesus says, "Who is my brothers and my sisters and my mother?" And then he looks at those that he's sitting with and says, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." In John 19, when Jesus is hanging on the cross, he looks down at his mother, and instead of speaking to one of his biological mother's brothers to care for Mary, Jesus nods to his disciple, John, and he says to his mother, "Woman, here is your son," and to John, "Here is your mother." Discipleship, relation to Jesus, trumps the biological family. Thus, I would suggest that the ongoing challenge for the church today is to continue to put hands and feet to the church's family. How do we create deep, lasting, committed, stable contexts in which people can flourish, whether they are single or married? And I think we probably are looking less for answers here and maybe more for experiments. I know of families that have purposely bought houses big enough for more than just their biological family, who have embedded singles as part of their family in a long-term way. I know of others who have determined in a way that is out of step with our highly mobile culture to not move, to stay in one place, to create the kind of stability and community that can only come with time. That's the first practical consideration, to deepen our practice of the church's first family. A second and final consideration to acknowledging celibacy as a gift, I think, is a move beyond thinking about it simply as a binary choice between a vowed lifelong call to singlehood on the one hand, and on the other hand, to automatically and unthinkingly assume that marriage is the right thing to do. Lauren Winner writes in her book, Real Sex, quote, "Perhaps we ought not fixate on the call to lifelong singleness. Some people," she says, "of course, are called to lifelong singleness, but more of us are called to singleness for a spell. Often, our task is to discern a call to singleness for right now. And that's not so difficult," she says. "If you are single right now, you are called right now to be single. Called to live a single life as robustly and gospel-conformingly as you possibly can." Elsewhere, she writes about the challenge to not allow our natural anxieties about getting married to distract us or rob us of the life we're to be living right now. When I consider those words, to not allow our anxieties about the future to rob us of the life that we're to be living right now, they make me wonder if perhaps the challenge of living in seasons of celibacy, but with a desire to get married, might actually be representative of a challenge for all of us in our spiritual lives more generally. And that is this: how do I live with both contentment and hope in seasons that I would like to be different, but over which I have limited control? I suspect that many of us will find this to be a perennial challenge in our relationship with God, because even the person who desires to get married and then experiences the fulfillment of getting married will eventually experience new seasons in which they would like something to be different, but over which they have limited control. Perhaps it's a challenging season in their family, or with their health, or with their career. And the challenge will still be, How do I live in this situation right now with both contentment and hope? How do I seek to do everything I can to make the situation better while still operating out of a deepening sense that no matter what happens, I will be safe in God's hands? The question for those living in that in-between place between singleness and marriage is, in fact, one iteration of a question for all Christians, which is this: what do we do with our desires and our longings? We are desire-haunted creatures who are never fully content in the state that we are in. And the challenge, rather than seeking to muffle or assuage those desires with lesser things, is to allow them to turn us to God. Henry Nouwen, right before he died, reflected on these questions, and he suggested that we do the following. We sit with our pain and our incompleteness and own it. We give up, he said, the false messianic expectations that we will someday experience just the right combination of circumstances to ensure complete happiness. We commit ourselves to the ongoing work of prayer, sitting still long enough for restlessness to turn into restfulness. And we remember that this process is never done once and for all. It is something that we enact time and time again as we continually ask that all of our desires ultimately lead us more deeply into Christ. Amen.